As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to a special host Game 5 of the Eastern Conference Final. Why not? Thing, right? There was Liam Neeson. There was Jimmy Fallon. There was no goals from home plate. A goaltending duel, truly, as the Tampa Bay Lightning won their third consecutive game against the New York Rangers in this conference final. It looked like it was curtains for the Lightning. But the thing about a great team, Farhan, is that when you have a shot to kill them, you better not miss.
Well, it's a great point. And when you look at this team and what happened in game three of this series, where 2-0 Rangers in the series, 2-0 Rangers in the game, and Tampa Bay comes back in the third period, full value in game four, where they were really the dominant team. And then you get into this game where the Rangers certainly had their chances. They had a lead in this game. You know, both of Sergachev's goals came from distance, which you don't expect from Shesterkin. And certainly a game at home that the Rangers had to feel good about on form. You know, this game could have absolutely gone their way. And now, if you're Tampa Bay, even though you haven't dominated any of these three games, you did for moments in game four, but you haven't been the dominant team at any point in this series, and you now have an emotional stranglehold on this series going home for game six.
Yeah, I mean, the Rangers, I thought until the third period, just looked like they couldn't generate anything 5-on-5. I thought in the first two periods, let me take that back. I thought the first 10 minutes, the Rangers were the better team. And then from that point on, they couldn't generate anything until the last 10 minutes of the third period, where I thought they were the team pressing. And it almost looked like the Lightning were content to go to overtime. And then you get that excellent possession. And you know, the Sergachev goal, the game winner, not a goal that Shesterkin would want to allow. But it came off some really good pressure from that Stamkos-Kucherov group. And puck goes back to Hedman, around to Sergachev, and Sergachev is able to send a really smart shot. I mean, one thing that should be noted, I do think it probably hit Palat's knee. We might see the scoring credit altered on that goal. But the shot itself was at a perfect height, perfect, like, here's an old school Canucks reference for our listeners, a perfect Lucas Krajicek, waist-high wrister.
Very strong.
from Sergachev. And, you know, that's a good shot. It's not a good goal, but it's a good shot, a smart play by a player who is surprisingly polarizing, I find. Like, for me, Mikhail Sergachev, like, if the Tampa Bay Lightning decide, not probably next year, but the year after, that they've got to move on from one of Cernak, Cirelli, and Sergachev, right? They're all on bridge deals. They're all going to be prohibitively expensive. And if Sergachev's the guy they decide to move on from, you know, I personally think you have to be at the very front of the lineup for it. And yet I talked to a lot of people around the league who are not nearly as high on him as I am. I see him as a guy who'd be a 55-point defender on 20 teams in this league. You know, a guy who'd be a star for a lot of clubs. And yet I feel like that's a controversial opinion. That's like me saying, you know, I think Connor Garland's a top line caliber player. There are people who agree, and there are a lot of people who do not.
Yeah, that's an interesting one for sure. And, you know, when you look at Tampa Bay and how they've managed to construct their team and reconstruct their team and tweak their team and kind of get it into position, you certainly look at him as a piece that they're going to be able to deem expendable. Like, he's not a core piece for them. And he might be for somebody else, but, you know, look at JT Miller, right? Certainly not a core piece for the Tampa Bay Lightning. And look what he's doing for the Vancouver Canucks. And Sergachev maybe doesn't have that kind of ceiling, but, you know, certainly a player that's going to add surplus value elsewhere and could be more valuable elsewhere than he will be for Tampa Bay.
Yeah, and it goes beyond Miller too, right? I mean, Blake Coleman in Calgary, Yan Gord, yeah, the top line center in Seattle. Obviously, Barkley Gaudreau's played a more prominent role for New York than he did in Tampa Bay when he was that third line fixture. And so we're at this point, right? The Rangers are going back to Tampa on the brink, and yet they still have Sergachev. They still have the better team speed. They still have this absolutely lethal power play. And yet it just feels like they're going to struggle so much to generate 5-on-5, particularly once Cooper gets the matchup game going. And, you know, I don't think it's a coincidence that the Rangers have struggled on the road, for example, right? Like, I think when teams are able to be like, LOL, Zibanejad, here's a steady diet of Crosby and Jordan Staal and Anthony Cirelli, you know, I think he's been less productive. And then at home, when Gallant can sort of get him out here and there and attack the soft underbelly of rosters, he's been more effective. And one thing I'll be curious to see is can Gallant, you know, who's got a lot of praise for this run and deservedly so, they've had a lot of success. Can he find some minutes? Can he carve out some minutes for Zibanejad's line, you know, against the Kucherov group, against, ideally, if you can hack it, that sort of Belmar, Perry, Nick Paul group too. I think that's incumbent on the Rangers to figure out. They need to find some way to generate something 5-on-5. And you know, it might take double shifting Zibanejad with some bottom six lines, might take double shifting Artemi Panarin with some bottom six lines, but you got to find a way to get some minutes from those two players out against Tampa Bay Lightning guys that are not named Anthony Cirelli, because he's just too good, man.
Yeah, he is for sure. And, you know, and here's the other thing. You know, you talk about Cooper being able to play the matchup game at home. Is there a better matchup coach in the league? And look, being a matchup coach is relative based on who you have to match up with, right? But, you know, like, even this year, when you look at this roster and the depth of this roster, when we talk especially about the third line relative to what Tampa's third lines have looked like in the last few years, you know, it's not as deep as the teams they've had before. And that showed at times in the Leafs series and at times in this series. But yet he seems to find that way. In your mind, is there a better matchup coach than John Cooper in the NHL?
No, I don't think there's a better coach in the NHL than John
That's
Cooper.
Fair.
I mean, it's incredible. And the matchup game is a big part of it. But, you know, I do think you've seen it too with Rod. I do think you've seen it too with Sullivan. Granted, I think pretty highly of all three of those bench bosses, but, you know, there's a reason I think that the Rangers have struggled to win on the road. And I do think they need to figure out in this do or die game six, what could be their last road game of the season, what I sure think will be, they do need to find some ways to get that group out, get their top players some minutes against the soft underbelly. I want to talk a little bit more about the Rangers because I've been a Rangers non-believer. I think the talent on the Rangers is pretty good. Like, I like the players I think the New York Rangers have the talent to do more than they do. I just watch, you know, after game one and two, everyone was praising them for, well, with Shesterkin back there, they can play run and gun. They can trade chances with the Lightning. And wow, what a great strategy their counterattacking strategy is. And it's not a lot different, to be honest with you, than what we saw the Canucks do sometimes, where it's like, oh, well, when you have Demko, you can open the game up a little more. Like, they don't need to be playing this cautious style. You know, attack off the rush as much as you can and trust that your better shooting talent will beat the other team's better shooting talent. Or, you know, we'll be able to best the other team more nights than not. And it's great when it's working, right? Like, it's great when Andre Vasilevsky is stopping 880%, like, sporting an 880 save percentage the way he was after three games. But when the other team comes up with a plan and starts to can opener you and starts to slow the pace down, do you have a plan B? You know, at the end of the day, if you're trading chances on the rush and being like, well, we have the better goaltender and we'll let our shooting skill take over, you know, you're just playing with fire. You're just being, you know, it's just luck over a long period of time. I just don't think it works. And so I sort of look at this Rangers team, you know, I've been calling them non-elite and people take that as this huge insult. And it's not. I'm just saying, for me, they're not a top 20% team in the league. They're good. They're very good. I'd probably have them in my top 10. But elite's elite for me for a reason. And for me, elite is top 20% of teams in a hard cap league. And that's seven teams this year. For me, to be an elite team, you needed to have a really high five-on-five gear, which the Rangers didn't. You need quality special teams, both sides of the puck, which the Rangers did have. And you need excellent goaltending, or at least very good goaltending. And the Rangers obviously have that. But they didn't have that one piece, that five-on-five piece. And I think you can see it. Like, you can see it in how they play without the puck. You can see it in the way that they want to win, how dependent they are on finishing luck and on goaltending performance. You know, the way that every team they've faced in the playoffs has generated at will against them off of set plays, off of draws. Which, again, not dissimilar from what we saw from the Canucks, even when they were winning in the latter half of the season. And, you know, that's a lot of loose change. There's, like, a lot of loose change that the Rangers leave on the ground. And against an opponent as good as Tampa, when you get to this point in the season, or say the Rangers win game 6 and 7 and end up facing Colorado, you know, there's teams that are happy to pick it up. Not every team in the league can, but there are teams at this time of the year. At some point, you're bumping into a behemoth like this, and they're going to pick up that loose change and happily add it to their own bankroll.
Well, yeah, there's no doubt. And, you know, when you look at this game, especially, like, you talk about them reliant on finishing luck and on elite goaltending. They've also been reliant on a pretty incredible power play for the most part right up until now. What do you make of what's happened to their power play in the last couple of games here?
I mean, they haven't had chances. Like, the big story for me is that the Tampa Bay Lightning have been super disciplined, right? They took a too many men on the ice penalty tonight, and their first penalty in game 4, if I'm not mistaken, occurred with the game in hand. Like, the Rangers' first power play opportunity, and they did end up scoring on one, came with 14 minutes left. No, that was offsetting minors. Came with, 3 minutes left in the game when Killorn finally took a holding penalty. And the score at that point was 3-0. So, you know, for me, the story number one is that they haven't had the opportunities. And in fact, they're what? 1 for 2? They're actually 50%. It's just that they're not getting the chances at this time. Like, you know, I think the refs become hesitant to call things. They haven't been throughout the playoffs, but I do think refs become hesitant to call things, especially when it's like the opponent that the Rangers are facing is this Tampa Bay Lightning team that's now, you know, one game away from being in their third straight Stanley Cup final. An accomplishment which, regardless of what happens against the Avs, if the Tampa Bay Lightning win one more game this season and go to their third consecutive Cup final, that is ridiculous. That is a truly ridiculous achievement. And who wants to be the guy responsible for ending that, right? The whistle's kind of, at some point in any playoff series or in any playoff run, will, you know, begin to shift away from you. And that's the problem of being too dependent on the power play for offense.
Well, when I look at Tampa, like, I'm so impressed with their understanding of how a game is going to get called very early in the game, right? And I think that comes from the playoff experience they've had. It comes from the coach that they have. And they have a real sense of where that game is headed. And they can play it any style, right? And that wasn't the case before they won their first cup. They had to win games a certain way. Now they can win it a number of different ways. So they're not reliant. They also skate well enough that they don't have to reach and get into those situations. And you don't have to go that far back to remember Calgary against Edmonton and how big of a factor the power play was in the early stages of that series, or really throughout that series. And Daryl Sutter was asked, like, how difficult is it to stay out of the box? And his answer was simple: well, stay out of the box. And that was a team that doesn't have the playoff experience and the common sense, or the hockey sense, the moment sense, to understand and feel how a game is being called early and being able to stay away from that stuff. They needed to play the game one way.
Yeah.
Right? And Tampa's versatility allows them to play so many ways that if the game's going to get called tight, they'll play it this way. If the game's going to allow you to run and gun, they'll play it that way. And that's the beauty of how that team's constructed, even with the changes they've had to make from last year to this year.
Yeah. In European soccer, they call it tactical noose, right? The Lightning are chock full of tactical noose, without doubt. And it showed tonight. I mean, what they've ended two of their wins here in the last three games. I mean, there was the Kucherov pass to Palat with under a minute left, and then they get the game winner tonight off of a really good shift from that top line with 90 seconds to play. I mean, those are backbreakers. And now the Rangers are on the ropes. You know, this series could be wrapped up and the Stanley Cup final matchup could be set as soon as Saturday night. So tough spot for the Rangers. They played well tonight too. But, you know, not that they deserved a lot better, in my view. Tampa Bay still hit three posts, right? New York's only goal was a soft one, right? A goal that Vasilevsky would want back. So I'm not going to sit here and say that the Rangers deserved better, but I didn't think they played poorly tonight by any means. And yet, you know, their backs are up against the wall. They can still win. They still have Shesterkin. They still have a ton of finishing talent. They still have this team speed issue. I doubt we see Braden Point now, right? I mean, if you're Tampa and there's even a chance that Braden Point can play in Game 6, keep him on ice until Game 7 at this point, and hopefully you win Game 6. If, from Tampa's perspective, hopefully you win Game 6 and he gets 5-6 more days before you know, you try and get him back for the Cup Final. I you know, it's an interesting spot to be in. It's been a really fascinating series. I think it's been can't miss. Honestly, I've really enjoyed just watching these games. Even when they haven't been high scoring, I think the level of competitiveness, the quality of the hockey and the quality of the drama that is Tampa Bay consistently figuring teams out is a ton of fun.
Now, as far as this episode of The Live Room is concerned, we still are a Canucks show. So at some point down the road here, we are going to take your calls, or we're going to invite you in. I should say not calls. We're going to invite you in on The Live Room to chat with us and any topics available. So you can talk about certainly this game, what a potential Stanley Cup final looks like. But anything you want to talk about as far as the Canucks, we're going to take your calls and get into all of that. We were hoping to have a guest for this show, but we're going to make sure that happens at some point next week when we get back at it. But we did want to get to a live room. These are so much more fun than a mailbag. And I know you did your mailbag on your other show, so we had to go creative. We had to let the VIP specifically get involved in this one, so it should be fun. But, you know, Drancher, for me, one of the things I'm always impressed about, and I find this in hockey more so than any other sport, and certainly football is different because there's no series involved in football. The emotional resiliency of hockey players in the playoffs always blows my mind, because you get teams that lose in the most gutting manner. You know, in real life, you shouldn't be able to emotionally recover from what happens in those moments. And you look at three straight wins right now, a couple of them decided in the final moments, this one with less than 2 minutes to go. And now they go back to Tampa facing elimination. Like, teams should not be able to recover from this. But in hockey, teams seem to find a way. You lose a quadruple overtime game, you come back the next night and win. You know, where are the Rangers at right now? Because on the surface, they were right in this game. They had every opportunity to win this game, even though you're right, 5-on-5, and for much of the game, Tampa was the better team. But How do they recover? How do they emotionally get a knot in that rope, hang on, and get back in this thing?
Well, one thing that I think is going to be incumbent on them, because the pressure is all on them now. You know, I really do think after you felt it after they blew that 2-0 lead in game three, that the pressure shifted, right? Because there's pressure that can stem from being on the brink of something. But for Tampa, they're not going to be affected at this point. They're Teflon, right? Everything's going to bounce off of them. But for the Rangers, there's also the pressure of missed opportunities that sort of permeates. And they were so close. They were so close. And then it all went against them, and they've now won three straight, or lost three straight, excuse me. And so one thing I think is crucial in that sixth game on Saturday, like they can't fall behind. You can't have the ticky-tack Tampa Bay goal, and then they do their boa constrictor act and just poke and prod and wait for you to make a mistake and then, you know, seize on you. They need to avoid that game script for me when they play game six. And then, you know, I'll go back to finding a way to get back on the man advantage. That Rangers power play is lethal. Every time they're 5-on-4, you feel like they're going to score, even though they didn't score tonight. And need to find a way to get Zibanejad and Panarin out against players that aren't Cirelli. But, you know, that for me, those are like my points 1, 2, 3. What do the Rangers need to do to get back in those series? That's it. That's the long and the short of it.
Yeah, you're not wrong in terms of those matchups and what they need to do. But I think John Cooper right now has Gerard Gallant's number. And I think being able to get back home and continue that, I think he's going to put a vice grip on. And I don't think that even those answers are going to be enough, right? They're going to need a couple of bad goals from Vasilevsky like they got in the first game. They're going to need to draw a few calls that they haven't been able to draw in these last couple of games. Some of those marginal calls, they're going to need to get the right officiating. And, you know, when you look at Tampa Bay and they get a chance to close out, they're not going to miss, man. They are not going to miss.
We know what Vasilevsky does in potential closeout games. I saw a great stat today on a free website that I quite enjoy called Twitter.com. I don't always enjoy it, but sometimes it's good. And
Twitter.com, I've never heard of it.
Yeah. I want to quickly pull it up for you guys because it's from Stephen Birch, who tends to tweet about the Maple Leafs. But he pointed out that if you go game by game for the Tampa Bay Lightning in this playoffs to this point, right? This is how the Maple Leaf series began. Toronto scored 5, then 3, then 5, then 3, and then 4, and then 3, and then by game 7, 1, right? Tampa or Florida 1-1-1-0, and then the Rangers scored 6, scored 3, scored 2, 1-1, right? As series go along, he pointed out, the Tampa Bay Lightning seem to adjust to their opponents, ratchet up the defensive intensity, change up the game plan, evolve to do what they're, you know, whatever they need to frustrate their opponent and impose their will on the series, you know, with increasing effectiveness as the series goes on. And, you know, one thing, a deeper Tampa Bay Lightning team last year had this marvelous ability where when they played their opponents, they played their opponent's game and just beat them at it. Something I don't know that I'd ever seen from a team before in the playoffs, but it was this unique form of championship swagger. So they play the Florida Panthers in the first round. This is I'm talking about the bubble season, right? I'm talking about 2021. They play the Florida Panthers in the first round and the Panthers want to play this run and gun hockey. And they're like, okay, we'll play run and gun hockey and we'll outscore you. Right. And then they play the Carolina Hurricanes and the Carolina Hurricanes want to play chip and chase and simplified defensive hockey at super high speed. And the Tampa Bay Lightning are like, okay, we'll play that type of game too. And we'll just do it better than you. And they won in, I think it was 6. And then they play the New York Islanders and the New York Islanders want to play this boa constrictor style. And Tampa Bay Lightning are like, fine, we'll play a low event game. Like, let's play a low event series. And then, of course, they win in game 7, 1-0 with a shorthanded goal being their lone marker. And then the Habs come and, you know, the Habs tried to do their, you know, between the whistle playoff warrior stuff. That's the that was the 2021 Habs game. And do you remember what Brendan Gallagher's face looked like? Lightning were like, fine, let's play that. Let's you guys want to try to punk us? We'll try to punk you, and we'll see who wins in the alley. And they won in five. And really, Montreal was extremely fortunate to get the one win they did. That was a gentleman's sweep if I've ever seen one. So, you know, they had this marvelous ability to process what their opponents were doing and just play in this really like stunning type of way, their opponent's style better than their opponents could. And now this year we're seeing a different team because it's a more limited team, especially with point out. And they're just able to process their opponent's attacks. And then as a series goes along, you know, figure out exactly how they have to play to limit all offense against them. And they're able to win like that. It's really been a remarkable run. And we've sort of seen three different variations of this team now, in my view, as they've made three consecutive deep runs here. Just tremendous. A really tremendous showing from a pretty special group.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, it's impressive that they've been able to do this, that they've been able to turn over the roster, continue to stay successful, find different ways to win in a salary cap world. And, you know, it, to me, and we're talking about this in the chat room on the side here, if they get to the final, and I know how fast Colorado is and how good MacKinnon and Landeskog, Tampa is more than fast enough. They're not faster than the Avs, but they're fast enough to win. And the goaltending matchup is going to be so one-sided in that series. And I know we're getting a little ahead of ourselves, but I will take Tampa all day in that series.
I'm not making a play. I'm not making a series pick until the ink is dried on the matchup. So I'm going to duck out on this one. I'm going to take the coward's way out.
Coward.
And I will make my pick next week once the matchup is set. Particularly, like, here's the thing, Farhan. If you get a playoff pick wrong, people are like, oh well, Farhan got a playoff pick wrong. When I get things wrong, right, there's like hundreds of people lining up to dunk on me. So I have to be careful. I can't make a pick before a team's been eliminated. I feel like I'm held to a different standard. No offense. It's how I feel.
You know, dude, you are. I get that feedback from when I pick football, but you were 1,000% right. Like, I actually picked the Edmonton Oilers to beat the Avs. Now, I didn't really believe it. I just kind of said it to play contrarian with you. I didn't get a single person criticizing my pick. Not one.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm sitting right now one series over 500 for the playoffs to this point. And so I haven't done great, but the ones that I've missed. So what, we're up to 13 playoff series decided. Is that right? 8 + 4 + 1. So yeah, 13 playoff series decided. I've got seven right, six wrong. Of the ones that I've gotten wrong, only two of them weren't decided in game sevens. So, and I'd add this, of the ones that I've got wrong, I picked all of them to go seven, indicating that I wasn't super certain. And yet I still feel like I get 20 mentions a day being like, rough playoffs for you, bud. So I'm not making a pick. I'm not making a pick before the ink is dried on the matchup. Next week.
Man up.
Next week.
Well, listen, I'll give it to you. We'll let you wait. Everyone's waiting with bated breath for you to make your picks.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
So why don't we get to some of the people that are here if they want to weigh in?
Sure, yeah. So if you'd like to raise your hand, we'll invite you up to the stage. You can, Jordy A is going to be our first invite, but if you'd like to join him and ask, and, you know, we'd love to talk Canucks. We're happy to talk about this series, but we'd also love to steer the conversation back to our area of expertise, the Vancouver Canucks in particular. So if you'd like to ask a question, raise your hand. We'll call on you in the order in which you ask your question. And if no one asks their question, we'll fill time and talk about the Canucks ourselves. Feel free also to ask questions in the chat if you're not comfortable speaking. We'll get to as many as we have time for this evening. And thanks again to the VIPs for joining us. We love doing this. We love this format. We love getting a chance to speak with you. And right now I'm going to invite Jordy A up onto the stage to chat with us. Hey, Jordy, how are you? You got me?
Good. Good, man. How you guys doing?
Doing well. Thanks for joining us. What do you want to talk about?
Well, it's interesting. Obviously, you know, the game's changed a lot. And I wanted to know your guys' take on the Trouba hit miss on Palat. Because I was thinking we're going to have three series in a row where Trouba's actually injuring someone. And, you know, I'm all for big boy hockey. You know, I grew up with the West Coast Express. One of my favorite memories is Bertuzzi destroying Chelios in the corner. But I just, with the game, the way it's changed, what are your thoughts on that? And just, you know, that could have gone quite poorly if Palat didn't have his head up.
Jordy, it's a really good question. Thank you so much. So I hated that attempted hit from Trouba today. I really dislike it. If you go watch the positioning on his elbow, if his elbow's tucked, it's not a bad hit. But his elbow could not be less tucked, right? I mean, to call it it was in a wing position, right? It was a straight, at that point, you know, that's...
Dude, he was reaching. He was extended.
Yeah. That's a bad hit. That's an injurious hit, in my view, or at least an injurious attempted hit. And, of course, Palat's too smart. Palat certainly is going to have Trouba's number when it comes to spatial awareness. And ducks the hit, so no consequences for a guy who, you know, in my mind, like, I didn't like the Crosby hit at all. You know, I don't think Jacob Trouba's a dirty player, per se, but I think he's a reckless hitter, for sure. And I think that's an edge for New York. Not even that he's not getting suspended, just that he's got that reputation. You have to be aware of him when you're on the ice as an attacking player. And, you know, I don't like it. I personally, I didn't like that attempt.
Hey, you know what? We need to be more aghast, because otherwise everybody in Edmonton's going to be upset that we're not aghast enough at somebody else's hit. We need to be angrier. We need to be just freaking out right now and demanding a 5-game suspension. Just for everybody in Edmonton.
Why everybody in Edmonton?
Well, because, you know, Kane got suspended. We weren't talking enough about McKinnon's play earlier in that series and others in the series. So, you know, that's kind of the way it goes, right? Like, you've got to – everybody's against Edmonton. They're the ones that get the bad calls. No one's upset at everything else. We're only upset about Evander Kane. So, look, we need to be aghast about Jacob Trouba.
Yeah, I mean, I am. No, right. I am aghast at Jacob Trouba. I also was aghast at Chris Kreider's hit on, was it Brandon Hagel the other day? Where that was the cross check. It looked an awful lot like, no, it was on Cernak. Kreider threw basically the Evander Kane hit on Cernak in game 4. And I was aghast that there was, you know, I think he did get penalized, but there's, you know, no even discussion about the hit afterwards. It's the same play. It's the exact same board with a cross check. To a vulnerable player, and Cernak's enormously lucky that he was playing tonight, that he finished game 4, in my view. So, you know, I am aghast. I didn't like the hit. I thought it was a dirty play, but, you know, I'm glad that Palat has the spatial awareness to have ducked it, and we'll see how game 6 goes. But yeah, I mean, I think Trouba's gotten away with far too much in this playoffs, personally.
Yeah, no, I would tend to agree. And like you said, he's not a player that's necessarily been known as a dirty player, but these are kind of when you were able to establish those reputations. And we may come back next year feeling very differently about Jacob Trouba.
Yeah, no question. Here's a question. We have a good question from Silas A, who asks, question about Rutherford retiring. Is he trying to build a pipeline for diverse candidates in management? And do you see the league or other teams making a pipeline for candidates of color in hockey operations? I think this is a fascinating question. I'd love to see it. You know, I do think we are going to see more teams Well, sorry, let me do an overarching criticism of the NHL in general, and teams in particular, which is that for me, you know, we're entering a new era of hockey management, in my view. And I think the sort of moment that I realized how quickly the rate of change could come was actually the day that Jim Rutherford got hired, but not because Jim Rutherford got hired, but rather because of something that happened that day in Boca at the Board of Governors meetings. And do you remember what it was, Farhan?
Tell me.
The John Henry Group, right? Which also owns Liverpool and the Boston Red Sox.
Oh, yeah.
We're talking about real quantitative money coming into the league. And that sale was approved on the very day that Jim Rutherford was hired. Additionally, the very next day, the NHL Board of Governors voted to allow private equity firms to buy stakes in hockey teams. And that quickly happened with, a certain percentage of the Tampa Bay Lightning and the Minnesota Wild selling to various private equity firms. Now, in the wake of the pandemic, as franchise values continue to skyrocket, I suspect we're going to see more and more of these types of interested investors, quantitatively based, right? High degrees of professionalism, high expectations of professional accountability within an organization. All of a sudden you're going to have hockey guys being asked to present quarterly reports. And for me, wow, that's going to be a massive change within the industry. I think we're just at the start, like we're on the precipice of a change that I think could come really rapidly and sweep through hockey. And I think once you have a different type of owner involved, right? Not necessarily the hospitality guys or the oil and gas money guys or what have you, but more organizations that function like MLSE does, right? Which, like, the Maple Leafs are basically owned by a pair of, are operated by a board of technocrats, right? You've got, the Josh Harris Group. We know that that's a pretty rigorous quantitative group. Vinny Viola in Florida, who I, of course, work for and know personally, would be another sort of example. I think as those types of people control teams, that you're naturally going to see a different type of workforce in hockey management. Now, I don't think that just means diverse candidates. I think it means non-hockey people. I think it means people with meaningful professional experience. I think it means higher levels of educational expectations in terms of executive leaders. I think it means an awful lot of things, but part and parcel with a contemporary professionalized organizational structure these days are meaningful D&I efforts. And you're already seeing some of that. You're already seeing the Toronto Maple Leafs create an effort to mentor and begin to develop. Like, they have a real mentorship program, a specific one, to begin to develop diverse candidates, people of color in hockey management and hockey operations roles. And I do think you'll see that model copied with increasing frequency as a different professional standard begins to permeate the league. And I just want to add one last thing really quickly, which is that this can't come soon enough. You know, the Chicago Blackhawks scandal, for me, the idea that there'd be a bunch of people meeting in a room and no one would at any point put their hand up and say, hey, what about our duty of care? Like, who cares about the Western Conference final in the face of this type of malfeasance? For people who we are responsible for as men of industry, as leaders, like, what are we doing? The sooner you get to a culture where that type of thing is expected, is a baseline expectation, as opposed to whatever ham-fisted cover-up resulted in a abuser going unpunished for just about a decade, and in fact going on to be hired by USA Hockey, where he went on to abuse minors. Right? A situation that was enabled by the NHL and in fact by the NHLPA as well, who should have known for sure. The sooner that comes to be, the better off this sport will be, the better off this entire league will be. Can't come soon enough, in my view. Anyway, that's my long answer to a question.
Well, no, and I completely agree with it. And I, I completely agree with it. And I try to draw parallels to what's happening in the National Football League, right? And hiring of diversity. And so much of the problem stems from ownership, right? Because in that particular league, the biggest problem you have is the age and demographic of the owners, right? And now owners are getting so much more involved in those types of decisions, right? So in a professional organization, you go ownership, president, GM, coach. And that's how the hiring happens. The president hires the GM. The GM hires the coach. Well, now owners are hiring coaches. And that's a problem, right? Because now it's not being done professionally. It's being done based on comfort zone, right? So, you know, I don't know that that problem extends to the same level in the National Hockey League. But certainly there is a problem. And whether or not it's going outside of the sport to improve the problem, I think it can only help. So in hockey, we're seeing a lot of accomplished people, accomplished females on the women in the women's game get meaningful positions in hockey. Some of it's on the television side. Some of it is on the operations side, like Cammy Granato. And, you know, you've got others. Emily Castonguay, who was an agent. Yes, she did play hockey before that as well. You know, Rachel Dory in the analytics department with the Canucks. But as you're able to expand outside hiring traditional hockey thinkers, yeah, you should open up the doors, right? And it could be people with a certain baseline of education, and it doesn't have to be former hockey players, because we so often get into this trap in any sport in terms of looking in the traditional talent pool verticals, right? Where do these people have to come from? Well, they had to have played before. Well, some of the best coaches in any sport were the worst players. Pick a sport and they're all over the place, right? Or, you know, or average players that are all of a sudden able to excel. And that's what we saw. Wayne Gretzky was never a great player. Or sorry, he was never a great coach, even though he was the best player of all time. So, you know, when you look at it, I think one way to fix it, like I look in the NFL, how do we get more head coaches of color? Well, we need to get more coordinators of color. Well, how do we get more GMs? Well, they had to have come in, you know, through this side, but the assumption is they always had to have been involved in the game in a meaningful way. Well, that doesn't have to be the case, right? As we start thinking differently in terms of how quality organizations are run and what ideas can come to the table. And I think hockey is probably a little late to the party in this, right? But I love what I'm seeing in the Canuck organization on the female side. And, you know, I hope to see more of it in terms of other forms of diversity. But that happens when you start thinking outside the box in terms of where you want to hire from.
Agreed, 100%. Let's get to a question from Jeff K. What are your guys' opinion on people that root for different teams round by round? My dad started with Toronto, then he cheered for Calgary, and then he cheered for Edmonton because he wanted a Canadian team to win the cup. I know, a true Canada's team guy. Now he's rooting for Colorado because they're in the Western Conference. What do you think of his rules for cheering? I've got no problem for it. I think it, you know, well, if you want to watch a lot of hockey and find it more interesting when you just like pick a team at random to have a rooting interest in, like, good for you. I love it. I have no problem with that at all. So long as you're not a true sports bigamist, you know, like so long as you know that when push came to shove, there's one team that you would always root for above all else. I'm all good with it. Wear the NFL logo hat to the game, Mr. Rob Lowe. Like, I'm all for it.
Well, for me, you know, number one, you cheered for the Leafs to start with because you were trying to ingratiate yourself to Drancher. That's number one. Then that went away. Number two, if you want a rooting interest, go bet. Right? That's the easiest way to come up with it. Go bet. If that's not your flavor, for me, the notion of a Canada's team is bullshit. It is complete bullshit. If you
there's a Canada's team. It's the Canadian national team.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's different, right? Like, yeah, I mean, we can all get behind Canada's national team because you're actually wearing the maple leaf on their front and it's red. It's not blue and white. So, yeah, that's the only exception for a Canada's team. But, you know, this notion that all of a sudden you're Calgary and you hate Edmonton and now Edmonton beat you and you're supposed to go cheer for Edmonton. Like, that's ridiculous. If you're a Canuck fan, why would you cheer for Calgary and Edmonton if those two teams are theoretically your biggest rival? Right. So, you know, you tend to try to, I think people always try to find morality in sports, right? So maybe Canada's team determines your morality, or maybe this team is, you know, they're a bunch of good guys, right? And, you know, like, I can't stand the Jays and I can't stand the Leafs. So, okay, I'm anti-Toronto, but I didn't hate the Raptors. because they just seemed like such an easy team to cheer for, right? And you look for morality. People hated the Canucks. The notion of a Canada's team should have gone out the window for anybody in 2011, because if you think they were getting a lot of love across the country, they weren't. And what did people say? Oh, Burrows and Kessler and these guys, how do you like that team? They're a bunch of hair pullers and just a-holes and this and that, and divers and whiners, right? Like, everybody looks for morality. I remember talking to people in the Chicago media, like professionals that were out here in Vancouver, and they would actually say to me, yeah, that Canuck team, they've got no soul, as the Canucks were pissing away a 3-0 lead. And then all of a sudden they happened to win in overtime of game 7. And those same people were like, well, yeah, they sure showed some character. Where's all this morality stuff coming from? They're a bunch of freaking hockey players.
Well, especially with what we'd later learn about some of the people held up as the good guys against the Canucks, right? I mean, the entire Blackhawks organization, Tim Thomas, go on down Absolutely. The list, right? Anyway, ridiculous. You're right. Imposing morality on sports is likely to age badly, because these are very flawed people and often very flawed organizations too. One thing I will say is I've found, I don't know if you know this, Farhan, but I don't bet on hockey. But I found that when I have really aggressive takes on teams and people hold me to them, that it raises the stakes for me watching the games, because I start to root for myself being right. So it's my way of wagering without wagering now, I've realized.
It gives me the same rush.
Gives me the same rush.
You know what? You don't want to win for the bet. You want to win just to crow. And like, that is the Drancerian comment of all time right there.
I know.
I just want to be able to pat myself on the back and say I was right. And then truthfully, like, I almost, boy, when Edmonton did play the Avs, because I was so pissed off at the reaction I got from Edmonton from the previous round. Like, I generally don't get that invested. I really don't care in most cases, but that was like the one moment that, did I want Edmonton to lose big time.
That was one where I was just watching and I was just like, there's not suspense here. There's no suspense here for me. I knew which way that one was going from the get-go. Hey, we've got a question from Joseph R. I'm going to invite him up to the stage. Hey, Joseph, welcome to the stage. Did you hear us?
Yeah, I hear you. Hello, Thomas. Hey, man. And hello, Farhan.
Hey, Joseph.
I got a question about the Canucks, actually. I'm a big fan of Nicholas Waugh from Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
And I love his size. And what's the best route for the Canucks to go and trying to acquire that guy this summer? And if I can also just ask, what are your guys' percentage of Jason Dickinson getting traded this offseason?
And all right. That's it. Perfect. A two-parter. We'll handle both. Let's start with the second part. Let's start with Jason Dickinson, Farhan. Jason Dickinson, how would you gauge the probability that Dickinson is traded? I'm going to expand the question. Sorry, Joseph, but I'm going to expand the question. What gauge the percentage Jason Dickinson returns for next season versus not?
Wow, I'm going to say 60-40, he doesn't. I believe the Canucks will make every effort to move him. I think it's going to be a tough ask just because of the season he's come off a year ago. But when you look at the number, it's not that onerous, and there are going to be some teams that will remember how he played in Dallas and view it as just a case of fit. The problem is going to be, I don't think they get off that contract scot-free. They're going to have to bring back somebody else that, was of a similar contract level with similar types of problems in another market. I don't think they get it back for a third-round draft pick.
I tend to agree. I think you've handicapped it right. I think the one thing I would say about Dickinson is I would not expect a buyout. That's the one thing I would not expect. And here's why. The deal is low enough that it's really only a $1.5 million hit if you bury it in the American League, right? Like, if you really wanted to carve out an additional $1.15 million in space, you just reassign him. He goes on waivers. Maybe he gets claimed. Probably not. And then you put him in the A and let him find his game there. And it's only a $1.5 million hit. For me, it's not even worth trading a third round pick to get off that contract when it's only $1.5 million, right? I wouldn't be rushing to do that. I also think there's a good chance he bounces back to some extent. Like, he's just not that bad. He's not as bad as he looked for the Canucks this year. I think he can be a helpful piece. Probably not the third line center the team envisioned when they signed that deal, but I think he can help them in some capacity on the fourth line. So overall, my view on Dickinson is don't buy it out because the money is too modest right now. If you can find a problem for problem trade, fine. You know, make it. Don't pay a future to get off of his money in a year in which you're not likely to contend anyway, right? That to me is a no-brainer. Do not bundle a third-round pick for him. If you can find, you know, if Edmonton wants to do Warren Fogle for Dickinson straight up, fine. But other than that type of problem for problem deal or, you know, a cash throw-in deal into a larger contract or a larger swap, you know, other than that, don't spend futures to get off the deal. If you bury him for a year, if you bring him to camp, see where he's at and then decide to bury him, you know, the deal is modest enough. It's not, you know, this is not the Louis Erickson contract for me. This isn't no. Having both Beagle and Roussel, right? It's, you know, $1.5 million liability if you bury him. Who cares? Don't spend futures to get off that deal. You can't afford to keep doing that when you're the Vancouver Canucks. That's sort of my quick take, my quick handicapping of the Dickinson situation. Question from Corey. Question for you two. Is there a player that may be there at 15 that you yourself would run to the podium to make the selection? Hey, Farhan.
Yeah, I'm here. Sorry, I don't know what happened there.
Neither do I. So did you hear the question?
No, go ahead. I heard the end of your Jason Dickinson take, and I know that we had the first question first on Waugh that we were going to answer second.
Oh, sorry, so right. We have to come back to that. Thanks for helping me out. So double back to Joseph. I think the way to get Nicholas Waugh out of Vegas is to take on a bad contract. So in order for the Canucks to, in my view, be a serious bidder for that type of deal or for that player, you know, sure, futures might get it done. A really good, affordable young player might get it done because Vegas has those cap issues. But I think fundamentally what you're going to need to do is take on an inefficient deal from Vegas. And I don't think the Canucks are going to be in a position to do that unless, you know, they're getting out of Ferland's money in the swap as well, or unless they are making another trade elsewhere to open up the cap space, to then weaponize the cap space to make that type of trade. What do you think, Farhan?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And you're right, right? Like, would he be a player that could elevate his value here in Vancouver? I think he could. I think he's a fit on a lot of levels. But they're not in there. Yeah, in terms of what it's going to take contractually to get that done, I don't think that's going to make a lot of sense for them. The Canucks are not going to be in position to take on that kind of deal.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I think it's going to be a tough one for them for sure. You know, Vegas is going to have a really fascinating offseason all around, I think.
We were asked in the chat as well about their ability to rebuild. What do you think? Like, what are the keys for Vegas to turn this back around in a hurry? Because there's still so much talent in that room.
Yeah, I don't know that it's going to take that much, to be totally honest with you, because they're good. You know, it's not like you have to rebuild the team. You just have to not have a catastrophic number of injuries in a very, very short stretch that submarines your season. Like, I don't think there's a lot of work to be done. Now, one thing I would say is, you know, I do hear that there's a bit of a split in terms of the original Vegas Golden Knights, like the guys who had success there right off the hop, and some of the stars that they've brought in since then. You know, I do think that there's some funky things going on behind the scenes and in that room. But you look up and down that roster and you got, you know, Nick Hague and, you know, guys like Coughlin, who I quite like, White Cloud, who I quite like, Theodore Martinez, Pietrangelo on the blue line. You've got Chandler Stephenson and Jack Eichel and Mark Stone. I mean, this should be the best team in the Pacific next year, in my view, without making really significant changes to the roster. Now, they're obviously going to have to do some clever things to manage their overall cap circumstances. I think they're going into this offseason with, I mean, they're going into this offseason with like $200K in cap space. And they've got some pretty important guys to sign. Like for me, Nick was an important guy to sign. Nick Hague is a very important guy to sign. So, you know, there's work to be done. Keegan Kolasar is a very important guy for them to bring back. So there's obviously work to be done, but I look up and down that lineup and I think it's the best on true talent in the Pacific, to be totally honest with you.
Yeah, I have a tough time arguing with that. I mean, I think coming into the season, most of us expected it to be Vegas as the top team. And I think we were surprised to see, you know, how far they fell. And I think we all expected them to make a late charge and be able to get into the playoffs. So I'm surprised it ended the way it did for them. But yeah, I mean, I think a bounce back season is in order. What's the right fit for a coach for that team?
I mean, hard to argue with Barry Trotz, right? Shouldn't they just go sign Barry Trotz?
But he fits everywhere.
Does he?
Right. Tell me where he doesn't fit based on the teams that know. I mean, a lot of people believe Boston made their move so they could go after Barry Trotz. Like, you know, I don't know that he's not a desirable option in any of the remaining situations league wide.
Yeah. I mean, I especially like him for Vegas, though. You know, I mean, I look at like,
why isn't it done yet? Like, why isn't it done yet?
Yeah, I don't know. They should make that happen, though.
No question. Yeah. I mean, and I look. When they made the change and moved off DeBoer, I thought that Trotz was going to be the easy answer there. So I'm surprised it hasn't been done, but there's got to be a reason. So we'll see if they get moving on it sooner than later. What are you hearing about Travis and the interest level in him and some of these available jobs?
Yeah, I mean, his name hasn't been front and center in the rumor mill. It's a very crowded market for head coaches generally. Trotz is sort of been holding it up. I'm actually surprised by how few, like, think about the fact that we're in June. It's June 6th at the moment, right? And there's what, 6 head coaching vacancies?
Yeah.
I mean, it might be more than that, to be totally honest with you. I'm actually just going to go look it up just because there's so many.
Boston got it to 7, did it not?
So yeah. Okay. So Boston, Dallas, Detroit, Philly, Vegas, Winnipeg. Those are the vacancies at the moment.
So still 6. Okay.
So still 6. There's still 6. And it looks like Dallas and Pete DeBoer, based on Elliot Friedman's reporting, are moving relatively quickly toward some type of a pact. So, you know, looks like we're going to be down to 5 in very short order. And then there'll be, 5 vacancies. And there's a ton of really good candidates out there. I mean, Claude Julien, Tortorella, Mike Babcock, if someone wants to go down that route, you know, there's all sorts of candidates. So we'll see. I think there's a couple of places that would be a good fit for him if they were to bring him in. The one that sort of I'd be most interested in to empathize with Travis would be Detroit. But I don't really have a ton of intel on exactly what he's looking at and what options he's considering. And we'll sort of see if he lands or ends up being speculated about more widely as the weeks go on. I would expect the carousel to begin to turn, though, in the next few weeks here.
I would agree.
All right. There's two more questions I want to get to, Farhan. And then let's call it. So, first up. First up, we've got one from, sorry, I just need to find it again. I had it and then I'd forgotten Nick Waugh. So the question was about who is there any, oh, right. Question for you two. Is there a player that may be there at 15th overall that you yourselves would run to the podium to make the pick? This is Corrier. Any draft prospects that, you know, TSN director of scouting Craig Button have specifically alerted you to Farhan that have piqued your interest?
Not yet. I'd be lying if I told you I dove into the draft. I've seen the standard names everybody else has been looking at, but I can't tell you I've got one they've got to take.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's Matejczuk, but I don't think the Canucks are going to pick him. So it's one of those where, for me, the obvious Canucks pick is another WHL player. I think he's going to be the best talent available when they select. And I don't think they like him. And I hope we don't regret it the way we regret Sordik and Stankoven and Gallagher and, you know, any number of names. Point. You know, go on. Sorry, did you guys lose me there?
I lost you. I just got you back right now.
Yeah, okay. So I'm hopeful that it's not that type of story for the Canucks. All right. One more that I wanted to quickly address. Someone asked about Fiala. Sage S asked, does Vancouver have the assets or interest in Fiala? Thanks, TD and FL. I think they have the assets for sure. Nils Höglander, I think, would be a very, very attractive option for Minnesota, for example, considering that they'd probably view him as a guy who can step into their middle six right away, has, you know, top six upside to help them get through the lean years of the Suter-Parise buyout. He was Judd Brackett was highly influential in that pick, and, you know, All up and down, I think there's a ton of reasons to like that fit from a Minnesota perspective. From a Vancouver perspective, one thing that's worth noting here is if you go look at when exactly Fiala broke out during that 2019-20 season, he really had his best month of that year, his breakout campaign, after Dean Evason came in, replaced Bruce Boudreau. Is there a fit there? I don't know. Like, I don't know. And part of the reason I'm not sure is Fiala's played his best hockey for an organization that Boudreau coached, but after Boudreau left. And, you know, I don't know how much, I can't comment directly on what that relationship is like, but, I wonder if that's an ideal fit for both sides, considering that history.
Yeah, it's a good question. But yeah, like in terms of who's been able to get the most out of him, certainly when you look at that one season, he's still been an elite player, but he hasn't been able to build on that year yet. And you know, look, it's only been a couple of years since, so I still think there's a level for him to reach, but they haven't been able to extract it quite yet.
Yeah, fair. And then one last one, let's end with this because it's a good question that we'll be able to get through quickly. It's from Peter D. Thomas, one word answer, please. Can this core compete?
No chance.
Need to blow it up. Compete or blow it up. I think there's a path to competing in short order, but I think it requires the club taking a step back on paper this year. I think with some bold moves.
Which word was that?
Yeah, so it's not a. I'm going to split the baby. I'm going to King Solomon this. I think okay. the answer is blow to. I think you have to, in the short term, not blow it up, but I do think you need to rejig an awful lot of what the Canucks are doing. Like, I still believe that this team cannot win with the defense core as currently constructed. Dermott helps, but I just think you're going nowhere with this defense core. And I think there's going to be, it's going to be a multi-year project to get that blue line to where it needs to be, in my view. And... you know, so as a result, I think this team needs to keep their eyes trained firmly on the long term. Should we end?
I can't argue with that at all. Yeah, I think we should. We got to finish on Canucks.
We got to finish on the Canucks. So thank you everyone for joining us. We'll do this again probably when there's news. I think the next time there's like big Canucks news, we'll do this again. We probably won't do another one of these in June. But I would expect, you know, we'll try and factor these in relatively regularly once there's like big Canucks news or trade or signing or what have you. When there's news to be broken down and discussed and gabbed about, we will be here live subscriber Q&A to do it all with you. Thank you guys for joining us. We love interacting with you guys in this format. All the best. Hope you enjoyed the live Vancast. And for those of you who didn't join us on the app live and in real time, we hope to see you next time. Remember to rate and subscribe. Remember to check out the other podcasts at The Athletic. Explore your other podcast options. I know that The Athletic NHL show is tremendous on a day-to-day basis. So thanks again. Thanks to you, Farhan. Good job, buddy.
All right. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye. Good night.